I have a question for you this morning. What do people see when they look at your life? What do they think about you and the way that you live your life? What do they see when they look at your life? I want to look at a passage of Scripture this morning that tells us what people should see when they look at us. It tells us what people should be saying about us when they look at our lives. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 4. The book of Deuteronomy highlights the unique relationship between God and his chosen people in the Old Testament, the nation of Israel. In the book of Exodus, a couple books back, Israel was in slavery in the land of Egypt. Through a series of miraculous events, God saved them out of Egypt, crossed the Red Sea with them, parting the Red Sea, and then drowned the Egyptian army as it sought to pursue them. And then having delivered them from Egypt, God enters into this special relationship with the nation of Israel, a relationship God had promised years earlier to their forefather Abraham. God made a covenant with Israel and used some really strong language to express his love for this nation. You don't have to turn here, but listen to some of the things God says to Israel back in Exodus 19. "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." God never says anything like this to any other nation in the Old Testament. No other ancient people is considered God's treasured possession. No other ancient people is considered a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. God sets the people of Israel apart to be distinct from all other nations in their relationship to God. But God doesn't just tell Israel that they're unique in Exodus 19. He then goes on in Exodus 20 to 23, and he tells them how that uniqueness is to flesh itself out. He gives them his laws, and he gives his laws only to them. Not to Edom, not to Philistia, not to Assyria, but to Israel. What comes to be known as the Mosaic Law sets down concrete terms for how Israel is to relate to God in their special covenant relationship with him. In obeying, they are blessed. In disobeying, they are cursed. The book of Deuteronomy, as we'll look at today, it outlines in detail all of the laws that God gives to Israel, as well as the covenant blessings and curses for obedience or disobedience to those laws. And one of the covenant blessings for obedience was inheritance of the promised land, was possession of this certain piece of real estate property. God didn't just bring the people of Israel out of Egypt to have them be nomads wandering the desert forever. He brought them out of Egypt with a clear destination in mind, the promised land. And in the book of Exodus, God makes it clear that Israel must obey his laws if they're to inherit the promised land. And yet, when they come to the border in the book of Numbers, the first time, they come to the border of the promised land, they send spies in, and the spies come back and they give a bad report, and they're fearful. They don't believe God. They disobey him. And so the people don't go in. And so God makes them wander in the desert for 40 years until that entire generation that failed to trust God dies. Now, when we come here to Deuteronomy chapter 4, Israel is on the cusp of the promised land once more, with that whole generation before having died. And for a second time, God reminds the people of their unique relationship to him, and of their need to obey his laws, and of the covenant blessing of the promised land for their obedience to his laws. Follow along as I read the first five verses of Deuteronomy chapter 4. "And now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the rules that I am teaching you, and do them, that you may live, and go in and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. You shall not add to the word that I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor, for the Lord your God destroyed from among you all the men who followed the Baal of Peor. But you who held fast to the Lord your God are all alive today. See, I have taught you statutes and rules, as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land that you are entering to take possession of it." So remember, this isn't the first time God is having this conversation with his people. Back in the book of Exodus, before failing to enter the promised land the first time, God says to the people, "Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. God had laid this out to Israel before. You are my unique people, on whom I have placed my special love. Obey my commandments, and I will give you the promised land. And now God says it again here in Deuteronomy. Through Moses, he says, listen, O Israel, to these statutes and rules. Do them in order that you may live and go in and take possession of the promised land. God reminds Israel that obedience to his laws would result in covenant blessing. So if Israel hopes to live and prosper in the land, they can't add anything to God's laws and they can't take anything away from his laws. Do what God has said and his blessing will follow. This idea is found in verses 1 and 2 and then again in verse 5 as we've just read, where Moses says, see, I have taught you statutes and rules as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. So I hope this all paints a pretty clear picture for us. One Old Testament theme we find over and over again is this covenant relationship between God and Israel. And these three main aspects we've seen both in the verses from Exodus and from Deuteronomy. The three aspects being, it's a special relationship, it's a relationship built on God's laws, and it's a relationship that involves covenant blessings, one of which we've kind of keyed on being the promised land. In these first five verses of Deuteronomy chapter 4, this theme, it's brought out for us again and again and again. But then we come to verses 6 through 8, where Moses adds something more. And these are the verses that I want to kind of key in on this morning. So follow along as I read verses 6 to 8. Speaking of the laws, Moses says, keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who when they hear all these statutes will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? And so we come here to verse 6. And Moses says something more than was said back in Exodus. Moses now says something about Israel's relationship to the surrounding nations, and he says it differently than we might have expected him to. Often when we think about or we read about Israel's relationship to other nations, it's typically one of animosity. The nations are Israel's enemies, and they're ultimately God's enemies. The nations, they worship idols rather than the one true God. And because of this, God has promised to completely annihilate those nations who specifically dwell in the promised land. And these specific nations have sinned against God. And because of their rebellion against him, it's right and it's just for God to wipe them out. It's not genocide, because genocide implies innocence. No, this is righteous judgment, deserving of God's wrath for the sin they have committed. And so all of this to say, I often think of the nations in terms of they're God's enemies, they're Israel's enemies, Israel is God's people, the nations are the bad guys, and the Israelites are the good guys. But then I came to verse 6 of Deuteronomy chapter 4, and it didn't fit as neatly as I wanted it to in my theology of the nations that I had put together in my mind. Shouldn't Moses be saying something at this point about God utterly destroying the nations in the land? Shouldn't God be saying something about the surrounding nations and their abominable practices? Shouldn't Moses be saying something about the complete destruction of the nations because they're God's enemies? He could have, and it wouldn't have been out of place at all. He said it before. I've read already of something he said about that before. But instead of driving home the point that the nations are Israel's and ultimately God's enemies, Moses says something slightly different that should give us pause. Here in verse 6, it doesn't change the fact that the nations are God's enemies, but Moses says something of the hope for the surrounding nations outside of the promised land. Moses says that these people, when the Israelites keep and do their laws, it will be their wisdom and understanding in the sight of the peoples. So don't hear me say that the nations outside of the promised land are no longer God's enemies when they sin against him, or that somehow God tolerates their sin. But it shows that there is hope for the nations surrounding Israel. Having destroyed the nations that live in the promised land, Israel was to then turn to all the other nations, but they weren't to turn to them and look to wipe them out and to exterminate those nations. Rather, this verse shows us that salvation was not to be found exclusively within the borders of Israel. It shows us that God means for his blessing to extend beyond the boundaries of the promised land. Like I said earlier, I've often read my Old Testament with this kind of narrow lens of good guys, bad guys, with Israel being the good guys and the surrounding nations being the bad guys. And that meant good guys were blessed, bad guys were cursed. But God didn't mean to confine his blessings to only Israel. Way back, Genesis chapter 12, God makes some incredibly important promises to Abraham, the forefather of the nation of Israel. God says to him, "I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed." God doesn't say, "In you, your family, Abraham, will be blessed." God doesn't say, "In you, Israel will be blessed." No, he says, "In you, all the nations, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Through Israel, God's plan of redemption for all the nations was to be carried out. Israel was to be a beacon of light to the surrounding nations. Israel was to be, in a sense, attractive to the surrounding nations. As God's people lived in obedience to God's laws, they were to draw attention to the greatness of God, and the surrounding nations were to see it. Israel was to cause God's enemies to stop and wonder, "Who are these people? They don't serve wood and stone images like we do. They serve a God unlike any of our gods. They serve a God that's unique. Who is this God that gives such good laws? Who is this God who draws near to his people?" Even in Israel's victories in war, as they conquered the nations in the promised land, the surrounding nations were to see the hand of God at work. Even as Israel wiped out the nations in the promised land, those nations surrounding the promised land were to see God at work winning those battles. They were to see the wisdom of Israel through their obedience and trust in God. And that was to attract them to God. The surrounding nations were to see something in Israel. They were to see something in the way the Israelites lived their lives that was to draw attention not to Israel, ultimately, but to Israel's God. In the ancient Near East, wisdom was highly prized. Today, people don't really go around talking highly of wisdom as something that they want to attain. But wisdom was very much prized in the ancient Near Eastern culture. Back then, people living in that area at that time were constantly looking for wisdom. And in Israel, the nations were supposed to see that perfect wisdom on display. They were supposed to see the wisdom of God on display in the people of God as they obeyed the laws of God. Let me say that again. They were supposed to see the wisdom of God on display in the people of God as they obeyed the laws of God. And this was to lead the nations to conclude, as Moses says in verse 6, "Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people." This was to be Israel's attractiveness. This was what was to draw attention to Israel and her God. That which the nations so highly prized could only be found among those who obeyed the laws of God. A prime example of this is found in 1 Kings. You can turn there with me if you'd like. I'm going to read several verses from there. 1 Kings chapter 10. The book of 1 Kings, during Solomon's reign, the kingdom of Israel was at its greatest point in the nation's history. Its borders were as large as they'd ever be. The temple was completed. The nation was overflowing with wealth. And Solomon as king was the wisest man on the face of the earth. God had blessed Israel for her obedience to his laws during the reign of King David. And as Israel prospered, the surrounding nations were to take note. There's one passage that highlights this, and it's found in 1 Kings chapter 10. I'm going to start reading in verse 1, and I'm going to read through verse 10. "Now when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. And she said to the king, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom. But I did not believe the reports until I came and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told to me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpassed the report that I heard. Happy are your men, happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom." And then hear this, verse 9. "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. The queen of Sheba heard of Solomon's fame. She heard of Israel, and she visited the nation, and she concluded, "Blessed be the Lord your God. Blessed be the Lord your God. He has loved Israel forever." That's some high praise for Israel. Here's an example of the wisdom of Israel shown through its obedience to God's laws, put on display for the nations and attracting the nations, drawing attention to Israel's God. Having looked at this example, however, Israel's history is marked not so much by their obedience to God, but by their disobedience to God. Over and over again, they sin against God. They reject his laws. They break the terms of their covenant relationship with him. And over again, they find themselves deserving of God's wrath and punishment for their sin. What we read in Deuteronomy chapter 4 was supposed to be the norm for Israel and her relationship to other nations. But instead, we find that an example like 1 Kings chapter 10 is really the abnormality. It's really the aberration. It's the anomaly. It's the outlier. Israel is not to be remembered for her obedience to God. But if we read our Old Testaments, Israel is to be remembered for her disobedience to God. And because her attractiveness to the nations was so closely connected to her obedience to God and his laws, God's people failed to live out their role as God's ambassadors to the surrounding nations. In fact, ironically, Israel didn't just fail to attract the nations to God, but Israel ended up being attracted to the gods, the false gods, of the other nations. The Lord had warned Israel of this temptation when Israel was to enter the Promised Land. This was one of the prime reasons God commanded Israel to wipe out all the nations dwelling in the Promised Land, so that Israel might not fall into temptation to commit idolatry. Moses said to Israel, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of, and clears away many nations before you, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you and he would destroy you quickly." Moses told Israel to make no covenant with the other nations. That sounds harsh sometimes to modern ears in our day and age, to this hyper-tolerant society we live in. Make no covenant? You can't even have an agreement with some of the other nations? Why not? Shouldn't Moses lighten up a bit? What's the big deal if Israel makes a covenant or two with these nations? Well, the big deal is that Israel had already covenanted herself to God. And to covenant herself to any other nation would have to mean worshiping and serving the gods of the other nations. And so God commands Israel to destroy the nations in the Promised Land. But rather than obeying God and doing just that, Israel allowed some to remain. And just as God said, Israel fell into idolatry, following after the false gods of other nations. And so Israel failed to keep and do the laws that we read of in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Israel failed in her role to draw attention to God amongst the other nations. rather than being the law keepers, they were the law breakers. And because Israel failed to keep and do the laws, Israel failed to be attracted to the nations. And ultimately, she was attracted to the false gods of those nations. So then, what hope is there for us? If Israel failed in every way to obey God, how can we hope to fare any better? A passage like Deuteronomy chapter 4 seems like such an inspiring call to action for the nation of Israel. Obey God and bring glory to him as the nations marvel. And if Israel had obeyed, we could easily see how this passage would apply to us today. Obey God and bring him glory as your friends and family members and co-workers and neighbors all marvel. But Israel failed to obey. So how can we hope to obey? Well, one has come who has not failed in every way as Israel did. One has come who has not failed in every way that we have. One has come who has obeyed God in every way that man could not. One has come who is not a lawbreaker, but a lawkeeper. For when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. Jesus Christ is the hope of God's people in Deuteronomy chapter 4, and Jesus Christ is the hope of God's people sitting here today as Grace Baptist Church. Jesus Christ is the only lawkeeper who has reconciled us, the lawbreakers, to God, the lawgiver. And now because Jesus has perfectly obeyed the law in every way we have not, those who trust in him for salvation are received by God as his adopted sons and daughters. And Jesus' spirit is put into us that we might then keep his laws, that we might keep the laws of God as Jesus did. That changes everything for this passage. We can keep and do God's laws because Christ has kept and done them for us. We can leave those around us saying, surely this is a wise and understanding people. Not because we are wise and understanding in and of ourselves, but because the wisest one, filled with more understanding than all men who have ever lived, has placed his spirit within us. We have been made right with the lawgiver through the work of his Son, in order that we might be lawkeepers who bring honor and glory to him. We might be tempted as we read this passage to think then that there's something special about us. What Moses told the people of God in the Old Testament applies just the same to us today. Keep and do the laws of God, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who when they hear all these statutes will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. We might be tempted to think, hey, I'm something special. People are looking at me, and they're thinking pretty highly of me. They think I've got something going on for myself. But any obedience to the commandments of God is not opportunity for us to take credit for our law keeping. Rather, it's opportunity for us to give credit to the lawgiver who has sent his Son to make us those law keepers by his Spirit. Moses isn't saying it's all about you. Moses isn't saying it's all about me. He's saying it's all about God. It isn't about the people who received the law, but it's about the God who has given the law and drawn near to his people. What a privilege we have to know this God, not just as one who draws near to his people in a pillar of cloud or in a pillar of fire, as the Israelites experienced in the Old Testament, but we know him as one who has drawn near to us by his Son. What a privilege we have that we have a God who didn't just draw near to us by dwelling in spirit in a temple behind a curtain. We have a God who took on flesh and dwelt among us, and who has now given us his Spirit who dwells in us. That is a God who is drawn near whenever we call upon him. And because we have such a God as this, we have no place for navel gazing. God has not set his love upon us because we're something. God has not set his love upon us because we're worthy any more than the Israelites were worthy for him to set his love upon them. Listen to what Moses says to Israel just four chapters later in Deuteronomy. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. It was not because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it is because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers, that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And then later Moses says, do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, it is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess the land. Whereas it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God is driving them out from before you, and that he may confirm the word that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. It is not because Israel had something to boast in that the nations would look on them and wonder. And it's not because we have anything to boast in that our friends and family and coworkers and neighbors should look on us in wonder. People ought to marvel. They ought to find something in our lives that draws attention to God because we are in relationship with a God who draws near to us whenever we call upon him and has given us laws that are for our good and his glory. People should wonder at us. People should pay attention to us because of our God. We have nothing to boast in concerning ourselves, but we have much to boast in concerning our God. So if we were to write up a short list of things Moses isn't saying in this passage, that would kind of be our first point on that list. It's not about us. Moses is not saying it's about us. The second point on our list might be something like this. What Moses isn't saying. If people see something good about you, then you must be obeying God. Moses isn't saying that either. He isn't saying that outward conformity to God's laws is pleasing to God, even if it draws attention to God from others. God's concerned with our hearts. So just because people might see something different about you, like they were to see about the Israelites, don't assume that you're okay and in right relationship with God. We can look good on the outside, but be filthy on the inside. We can deceive ourselves and even others by the way that we live our public lives, even when we privately are far from God and his ways. God is concerned with our hearts. And for that reason, Moses isn't saying, if people see something good in you, then you must be obeying God. Because people can see something good in you that's just a mask to disguise what's going on inside us. So don't be fooled. Just because people see something in you on the outside doesn't mean that you're obeying God on the inside. And the third and final point on our list of things Moses isn't saying is this. As we obey God, everybody will like us. That shouldn't be our life goal anyways. We shouldn't be concerned with whether or not we're liked by people. That also doesn't mean that we shouldn't go around just being jerks to people. We should live God-honoring, humble, quiet lives, seeking to live at peace with everyone. But we shouldn't be living to get people to like us. And furthermore, we shouldn't expect people to like us because we live God-honoring lives. You could get the wrong idea from this passage when Moses says that Israel's obedience to the laws of God would lead the nations to say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. You could kind of conclude that Moses is saying, as you obey God, people will like you. People will think highly of you. But it's so much bigger than that. As I've already said, our obedience to God isn't about how people will end up thinking of us. And the way that people think about us won't always be good. The way we live our lives won't always be attractive to people. Jesus made this clear at the Last Supper when he said to his disciples, if you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. The gospel is not always attractive. To some it is, and to some it isn't, by the work of God. Through us, God spreads the fragrance of the knowledge of Christ everywhere. To those who are perishing, we are a fragrance from death to death. To those who are being saved, we are a fragrance from life to life. And so we ought to obey God. We ought to live lives that honor God. We ought to share the good news of the gospel of God without concern for whether people like us or not. So Moses isn't saying in this passage that it's all about us. And he isn't saying in this passage that it's all about what people think of us. So the question remains, what is Moses saying in this passage?
what is this passage all about?
What's the central point of Deuteronomy 4, 1 to 8? I think it could be summarized in this one simple statement. As we obey God, we adorn the gospel of his Son. As we obey God, we adorn the gospel of his Son. You see, this passage is about extending the fame of the lawgiver we obey. This passage is about extending the fame of the lawkeeper who has made us able to obey his laws. And as we do what God says to do, we show forth the beauty of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Deuteronomy 4 is not about us and our righteousness. Deuteronomy 4 is not about us and our standing before others. This is about God and the beauty of the gospel. In life, there will be people who like you. There will be people who don't like you. But whether they like you or not, your life should cause them to stop in their tracks and pay attention to the God you serve. Your life should draw attention to God and his great worth. Your life should be so bound up in the gospel, bound up in the good news of salvation, that people can't deny the reality that we serve a God who has drawn near to us. There is no other God. There is no other hope for the world. We have tasted and seen that the Lord is good. May people see that in you. May people see that as they look at your life. May people see that in you as you go to work tomorrow, as you have lunch with them tomorrow. May people see it as you go to the gym or as you coach your kids' t-ball team. Wherever you are, in whatever you're doing, may people see in you that you serve a God who has drawn near to you through his Son. The lawgiver has sent his Son to make us, who were once lawbreakers, now lawkeepers. And as we obey his laws, may we adorn the gospel of his Son. And may people look at us and see in us the work of God through his Son. May they look at us and say, surely this is a wise and understanding people. Not because they see a people worthy of praise, but because they see a God worthy of praise. Not because they see a people righteous in and of themselves, but because they see a God who has made them righteous through his Son. Others should look at us and see something in us, because they see a God who has drawn near to us and has made us his own. Let's pray together.